Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
This is a community of widows. Most of the men from the last generation are gone, died of cancer. The dump is a health issue to the black community in the south end of Shelburne. Has been and still is until it's cleaned up properly. That's, to me, is environmental racism. To me, that's what it is. The men from my father's generation, my brother's generation, were exposed to are gone. The men are gone. They died. They've died of cancer. We don't know what we've been exposed to that dump. We have no idea. We know that there's high rates of cancer among the community, and this is all anecdotal information, but people are dying at rapid rates from rare cancers in this community, black people, and we feel it's from the dump. We lived and played when we could outside next to that dump. And that is an issue because when that dump was set afire, the air would be full of smoke, there would be ash, there would be smells that you couldn't stand it, and rodents. Never seen a bird for days. Seagulls wouldn't even, when it wasn't a fire, there would be thousands and thousands of seagulls. So you can imagine the rats that were there. The soil has got to be contaminated. Like, you know, the Navy base would dump stuff there. Like, they'd go by sometimes twice a week in hazmat suits and dump stuff, barrels of things over the side of that dump that kept growing and growing and growing. They placed it there because they figured we weren't worth what somebody else was worth. Our lives meant nothing. And that our homes were not as good as theirs and weren't as, we weren't as wealthy as they were. We were second-class citizens with no value. My sister has multiple myeloma. She survived multiple myeloma. And multiple myeloma is a very rare kind of cancer, but it's been 4 cases of multiple myeloma in the south end of Shelburne. We have a right to good, clean air, good, clean water, and a healthy life. That right was taken away from us by placing this dump in our community. It was wrong.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, March 19, 2020. So I have been told. This is our weekly book study. Since everyone is on lockdown, quarantine, working from home, there should be lots of opportunities to get in more reading. All of this does not mean all I can do is social distance and Netflix and Hulu and stream it up, YouTube it up. Contraire, mon frères, we can go old school, grab a book. You can even do some screen time, pull out that tablet and do a little reading. Book study continues. China virus or no? Our fourth installment, Packing Them In, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington, An Archaeology of Environmental Racism in Chicago, 1865 to 1964. We are picking up on the subsection Gender, Technology, and Environmental Justice as we move towards the conclusion of the text. The audio that we heard at the beginning of the book, that is one of the more striking reports that we've played on the cows over the years. That is a little snippet of a longer segment from CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company, where they did a big segment on white supremacy racism in Canada, and a part of that segment was environmental racism. And they went and spoke to a lot of black people. Unfortunately, it was absent many black males because, as you heard, this area is known as the community of widows, where it seems that there may be some sort of gender and ethno-specific targeting of black males with this environmental racism, chemical and biological warfare. But they gave a lot of details that has impacted everyone living there. Another illustration of why it is incorrect to say community, because if you've got chemicals that are killing off black males, black females, black children, poisoning all of these folks, well, then you don't have a community, particularly if you are helpless to do anything about this. But we've heard similar illustrations. Dr. Hood has been talking about this in Chicago for the bulk of the book, in North Carolina. I think we had the segment last week, Louisiana. They call it Cancer Alley. All these creative names for chemical and biological warfare, most often targeting black people. The real global pandemic, racist man, racist woman, racist child. We'll get to that China virus, too. Alrighty, book club, Packing Them In, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one.
Gender, Technology, and Environmental Justice. Although it was a contributing factor, McDowell's command of the English language wasn't the primary reason for her potential to be an effective spokesperson for Packingtown. Her social standing and connections were the key factors. Mary McDowell was also closely connected to Jane Addams and had started her social service career in Hull House's kindergarten. Immigrant women of Packingtown had not developed the requisite social and professional standing that would have allowed them to interact frequently and effectively to present their environmental causes to the type of audiences and social circles to whom McDowell preached her gospel of municipal housekeeping. In a 1914 Lithuanian newspaper editorial, the writer described the status of women in their American communities and decried, "A deplorable attitude towards women has become rooted in the minds of most of our people. A girl, they believe, should be concerned only with getting married, and once she has married, her sole duty is housekeeping." Although middle-class and upper-class native white women did not hold or wield the same type of power as their male counterparts, they were part of the power relations in Chicago. These women had access to and influence upon male leadership through their social, political, and personal relationships. As relatives or members of the same social class, they were able to influence the social and political dynamics of the city. These relationships contributed to their success in philanthropic and social work efforts. For example, Mary McDowell was able to successfully present her argument about the troubles in Packingtown to the Hyde Park Presbyterian Church. She writes, "It was here that in one of the front pews sat a just judge who came up after my speech to say, 'If you would come to my court tomorrow, I will give you an injunction against the health department to prevent further dumping of garbage on Lincoln Street. I never knew where our refuse was taken.'" McDowell's activism resulted in her receiving the nickname of Garbage Lady among both her immigrant neighbors and her political and social peers. The title had as much to do with her political activism as the technical expertise about sanitation she acquired by studying the available books and monographs dealing with garbage disposal. According to McDowell, she developed this expertise because whenever she went to speak, she was confronted with the question and the comment, "What else is there to do with the garbage? It evidently has to be dumped somewhere. If we abolish the Packingtown dumps, that will only transfer the nuisances to another section of the city. We can't gain anything by changing garbage systems until we have a better system to substitute for what we have now." Howard Wilson's biography of McDowell points out that she became a self-taught sanitation engineer because she had become keenly aware of and aroused by the environmental inequalities that existed in her community, and the needs of her immigrant neighbors spurred her on. Unlike the average immigrant resident of Packingtown, McDowell had access to manuals about garbage disposals, as well as the time and the language fluency to develop the requisite expertise. Under the sponsorship of Miss Ethel Sturgis Drummer, McDowell spent the summer of 1911 studying methods of garbage disposal in operations in the largest European cities of England, Scotland, Holland, and Germany. She found there in the old world cities which had eliminated the evil effects apparent in the Chicago methods of disposal, and which had even made the garbage a source of financial profit. Mrs. Drummer, a prominent upper-class native of Chicago, was an education and health reformer and the wife of William Francis Frank Drummer, vice president of the Northwestern National Bank. It was in Europe that McDowell saw firsthand that waste disposal practices in urban and industrialized cities could be controlled and managed for the benefit of all citizens without deadly public health consequences. She learned about European methods of incineration and early forms of waste recycling for fuel resources. She saw that special types of garbage could sometimes be burned as fuel for the generation of electrical or steam power, and used for the operation of street railways, laundries, baths, or lighting systems municipally owned. Immigrants in the back of the yards were wise in selecting her as their environmental advocate, since there was very little chance that an immigrant would receive the same type of sponsorship. Cognizant of the relationship between power and knowledge, McDowell utilized her connections with the news media to educate the public at large and generate sympathy for the environmental plight of her immigrant neighbors. While still in London on her return trip from Europe, she reacquainted herself with a correspondent from the Chicago Daily News, whose acquaintance and friendship dated from the days of the Packingtown strike, and she told him how she had spent her summer. McDowell then gave the reporter her consent to write and send a story about her activities to the newspaper. The story was sent, and thus, even before Mary McDowell reached her home, her summer of work in Europe began its conscious talk of creating public sentiment in Chicago. After her return from Europe, McDowell again appeared at clubs and societies and churches and organizations, armed with stories of actual living conditions in Packingtown and with stereotypical slides and factual analysis showing practical solutions. All of McDowell's activities took place before Illinois women were given the right to vote in 1913. This is an important point because all of the historical material on McDowell consistently asserts that her goal was to change public policy by changing public opinion. McDowell was politically astute and knew that the power of the voice was key to having direct influence on public policy. Another event had occurred, however, with a direct and influential bearing on the garbage situation. Women's suffrage had been accepted in the municipalities of Illinois, and with it, the pressure of public force had increased tremendously. Prior to receiving their franchise, Mary McDowell and Women's Waste Committee clubs consistently petitioned City Hall to take a more scientific approach to the garbage problem by examining the available technologies. They were ignored until they received the franchise. McDowell noted that the first visit of the Women's Committee made to the City Hall the week after receiving the vote brought the same plea for a citywide plan based upon a scientific study. Our breath was taken away to find that our votes were so effective that an appropriation of $10,000 was made in 10 minutes and a commission with two women on it was appointed. The City Waste Commission began its work in the very next week. Two experienced experts in incineration reduction systems were hired to study the report. For decades, Mary McDowell, her contemporaries, and the immigrant women in the back of the yards waged battles of environmental justice in their community. They protested, petitioned government officials, and found ways to get their story into the news media. All of this historical evidence show that they felt there was sufficient evidence to demonstrate that these immigrants were the victim of both the not in my backyard attitude and what I have termed the put it in the immigrant's backyard syndrome. After all, the prevailing thought among the body politic was the immigrants were socially marginalized. Like many environmental justice activists today, they were unsuccessful in completely resolving all the environmental inequalities on their own. This was no doubt due to the fact that they were women and social minorities who ultimately were not in control of the final decisions governing the environmental policies and planning for their own geographical spaces. Although they won some of their environmental justice battles, their efforts alone were insufficient to stand against municipal politics that wanted to use the area as the city's ultimate sink. An example of this lack of power was the citywide plan to reduce the garbage problem by purchasing the reduction plant and building two incinerator plants on the same site. This plan was conceived by the city as a result of the immigrants' environmental activism. The plan was approved but was ultimately defeated by a new Republican mayoral administration that had no relationship or history with these female environmental activists in the back of the yards. The primary environmental solution for immigrants living in the back of the yards was physical relocation into the suburbs or less polluted areas of the city. For many, this was a difficult, although not impossible, task. These immigrants were marked by language and cultural habits from old Europe. Many did not want to leave the cultural and social security of their ethnic enclave. From an environmental standpoint, the greatest contribution of settlement workers like Mary McDowell to immigrant communities was the assimilation of their latter generations to the point where they could be accepted as white and gain access to healthier living spaces if they so choose. Immigrants who were financially able and willing began to escape from the environmental degradation and move to other, less polluted communities or into the suburbs. As Chicago historian Thomas Philpott's History of Chicago's Slums and Ghettos revealed, immigrants of all ethnicities, alien as well as natural citizens, Catholics and Jews alike, had access to neighborhoods where Black Native Americans could not go. Chicago communities that defined themselves as white and that enacted and enforced racially restrictive covenants or participated in sometimes violent measures to keep these geographical spaces racially white were composed of a large percentage of ethnic groups. Philpott observed in 1930, 70% of white Chicagoans and 54% of white suburbanites were foreign stock. Thus, any community that was only 40 or 50 or even 60% ethnic could qualify as American. For immigrants who remained in the back of the yards area, the environmental inequalities were resolved only after businessmen and male politicians decided that the pollution in the area was a threat to Chicago's City Beautiful Plan. Their solution to the environmental pollution and environmental inequities in the back of the yards, discussed at length in the next chapter, was to destroy Bubbly Creek by filling it in and making it into a great thoroughfare as envisioned by the City Beautiful Plan. Chapter 4, Engineering and Environmental Inequality, The Rise and Fall of the Notorious Bubbly Creek. All forms of power draw some authority by referencing to scientific truths. Michel Foucault. The resolution of environmental justice struggles in the back of the yards, as with modern struggles, occurred because of the power relation that involved a legal process contingent upon the scientific, medical, and engineering validations of the truth of negative environmental health impacts to communities claiming environmental inequalities and racism. Current claims of environmental racism rest upon an argument that the community's health is damaged by virtual pollution stemming from industrial operations through engineering design and waste disposal practices. Likewise, any validated claims of health damage always produce a concomitant demand for changes in engineering design and operation to ameliorate environmental pollution that created the environmental inequalities. An example of this power-knowledge dynamic occurred in July 1998 in Grand Bois, Louisiana, when Haman Indians and Cajuns lost the battle for environmental justice against the oil industry because they failed to provide truths that could convince the courts that their health problems stem from the industrial operation and waste management practices of the Campbell Wells and Exxon oil companies. Although Campbell Wells would settle with the residents out of court, jurors did not accept the community's scientific experts' evidence that Exxon had caused them physical harm. Bubbly Creek, the major source of environmental health problems and the ultimate sink for most environmental waste in the back of the yards, was originally located in the town of Lake. Its environmental state was strongly influenced by the power relations that existed among the packing house industry, civic, commercial, political, and engineering leadership in Chicago, the state of Illinois, and the federal government. Despite local ordinances and state and federal laws, the marginally controlled waste disposal practices of the packing houses, slaughterhouses, and tanning industries corrupted the environmental integrity of the creek. These were the polluting industries that have been forced outside of the physical space of the city of Chicago, far from its social body, because of fears of cholera and typhoid fever from waste disposal practices. Fully cognizant of the environmental inequalities that have been produced from their own industrial operations, the packing house industry and its industrial allies engaged in a complex set of power relations to have a large portion of the creek destroyed. Supported by the local engineers, industrial and civic leaders in Packingtown were finally able to successfully advocate for the destruction of Bubbly Creek in 1923. The federal government declared it a non-navigable body so that the city of Chicago could complete the construction of a major road. The change of status to this non-navigable body allowed the creek to be filled in and paved, thereby extending Pershing Road in accordance with the Chicago Plan, an initiative by the city's Chicago Plan Commission to develop an arterial urban transportation network consisting of classes of streets, conventional residential streets, avenues for through traffic thoroughfares, and landscaped boulevards, which combine the corridor park and the drive. The planners envisioned and pushed for the closing of Bubbly Creek, which was technically and legally referred to as the West Fork of the South Branch of the Chicago River, so that the Pershing Road and major Chicago thoroughfare could be extended and become one of the great traffic arteries of the west and south sides of the city. The filling in of the creek was only one of the engineering's solution to eliminate it as an environmental nuisance. The other alternative that had been used in the past to clean the creek was to dredge the body of water and remove the waste products that were the source of its pollution. The fill-in approach was the engineering solution supported by both city planners and industrialists, who publicly claimed that this method would help them to achieve a city beautiful for the benefit of workers and residents living in the back of the yards, as articulated by the Chicago Plan. The objectives of the industrialists and planners to eliminate the creek, however, could only be achieved with the mutual support of engineers, planners, and local, state, and federal government officials. The powers who sought to eliminate Bubbly Creek for the purpose of extending and completing Pershing Road were met by a vociferous and extended challenge from multiple powers exerted by other engineers, lawyers, statesmen, and business owners who had their own plans for the river and questioned the purported altruistic motives of Chicago engineers, business, and politicians in creating a city beautiful. As a result, the drive to destroy the environmental nightmare of Bubbly Creek was held up for almost 30 years, even after the federal government declared it to be a non-navigable body of water. The primary dealing in closing the creek was due to federal support and economic interest in the state of Illinois' plan for the development of a deep waterway connecting Lake Michigan to the Mississippi River. According to the media, however, the delay was caused by two businesswomen, Olive and Dolly Leach. The Leach sisters were part of Chicago's social elite and landowners in the back of the yards. By the time Bubbly Creek became a heated public controversy at the local, state, and federal levels, the Leach women owned only 3 acres of an original 40 acres of land that included riparian property situated on the south bank of the creek. All of this land had originally been owned by Dolly Leach's grandfather, Benjamin Wilder, in 1869. In 1874, the Leach property became part of a subdivision of land that was split between the two women, the Central Manufacturing District and the Mechanical Manufacturing District. Dolly's mother, Miss Robert Leach, inherited the land from Wilder in 1875 after his death and left the property to her son Robert. The land was then passed on to Dolly and Olive Leach in 1912 after the death of Dolly's brother, Robert, a distillery owner in Packingtown. Prior to the transfer of the land to Dolly and Olive, Robert gained permission to several transportation companies supporting the packing industries to cross the land. By the time the property ended up in the hands of Dolly and Olive, it had been leased for 36 years to the Stockyard Company and subleased to the Chicago Junction Railway Company and others, which constructed railroad tracks over it. The Chicago Junction would become a strong proponent of the destruction of Bubbly Creek and would try on 3 occasions to unsuccessfully take possession of the land from the Leach women by condemnation from 1916 to 1934. On April 30th, 1934, the injunction the company had brought against the women dissolved and the railroad tracks were removed. The Leach women then filed a lawsuit against the Chicago Junction, asking for $2 million for the rental of their property while their tracks were on it. The media blamed the delay in closing Bubbly Creek on Olive Leach, a graduate of the Chicago Law School. She argued that Bubbly Creek was still navigable water protected by the United States government that, despite state and local laws, was and had been under environmental assault by uncontrollable and legal industrial practices. She decried the force of the power relations that sought to fill in Bubbly Creek. She asserted before the U.S. Congress and in several lawsuits for more than 10 years that the city of Chicago, the sanitary district, municipal corporations through the City Council of Chicago, and officers of the state of Illinois did collude and conspire with the private corporations, the Union Stockyards and Transit Company, and the First Trust and Savings Bank by fraud and misrepresentation did unlawfully and illegally close the South Branch of the South Fork of the Chicago River, and the Secretary of War and the chief engineers of the United States government cooperated with these private and public corporations to jointly, illegally, and unlawfully, by fraudulent misrepresentation, cause the above described part of the Chicago River to be filled and the right of navigation thereon to be destroyed. The existence of environmental inequities in the back of the yards, although visible to anyone living or visiting the area, had to be publicly validated by the environmental truths of the engineers, scientists, and medical professionals before any legal action could be taken to ameliorate the environmental nuisances. This scientific and technological validation of water pollution and its environmental consequences by engineers was a classic example of Foucault's thesis that the execution of power works in tandem with knowledge. Leach's assessment supported Foucault's belief that there was no power relation without the correlative constitution of the field of knowledge, nor any knowledge that does not presuppose or constitute at the same time power relations, manifested into the battle to have Bubbly Creek declared non-navigable water. In this case, it was the engineering power knowledge that facilitated the power relations needed to destroy the creek and eliminate an environmental nuisance that disproportionately impacted Eastern European immigrants living in the back of the yards. Despite the legal power and scientific power that the Leaches brought into the power relation, no doubt their gender impacted the saliency and acceptability of their argument. No other opponents of the fill-in for Bubbly Creek would be demonized in the public eye the way the Leach sisters were. Contemporary articles appearing in Chicago newspapers portrayed the Leach women as being the thorns in the city's plan for ameliorating the environmental problem and its desire to develop the area. The Irish lit Bubbly Creek, now they can go to the zoo, ran in the Chicago Daily News. Close Bubbly Creek urges Commerce Body ran in the Central Manufacturing District magazine. None of these articles ever mention the Illinois Deep Waterway and the role of the state in initially halting the project. Rising bubbles, polluting the creek in the back of the yards. Bubbly Creek, also known as the West Fork of the South Branch of the Chicago River, represented the horrific environmental conditions in the back of the yards produced by the packing house industries. As discussed in Chapter 3, the creek was one of the worst polluted water sources and one of the most identifiable landmarks in the region. The environmental and public health consequences of that pollution were not limited to one place. They impacted an entire region. The goal of this section of the chapter is to elucidate an environmental history of Bubbly Creek, which explains how it became an environmental problem for Chicago. A number of environmental histories have already been written that examine or include the history of the Chicago River. These include Lewis Kane's Sanitation Strategy for a Lakefront Metropolis, The Case of Chicago, William Cronin's Nature's Metropolis, Thomas Leblonsky's Pride in the Jungle, Community and Everyday Life in the Back of the Yards, Chicago, Donald L. Miller's City of the Century, and Louise Carroll Wade's Chicago Pride, The Stockyards, Packing Town, and Environments in the 19th Century. None of these provide a complete history of Bubbly Creek, nor do they examine the critical role of engineers and planners in the power relations that both created and ameliorated Bubbly Creek as one of the primary sources of environmental inequalities for immigrants in the back of the yards. Bubbly Creek originally flowed north into Lake Michigan, the source of the city's drinking water. Organic waste poured into the creek by the packers produced a sanitary nightmare that resulted in thousands of deaths from typhoid fever, cholera, and other sewage-related illnesses in the metropolitan Chicago area. In his 1869 report in the Illinois State Board of Health, Dr. John H. Ronch, sanitary superintendent of the city of Chicago, would state that the amount of sewage generated by the slaughterhouses by 1863 had grown so large that it had become equal or exceeded the amount produced by the human population. As a result, the city's sewage system could not keep up with the production, and in 1863, a remarkable epidemic of erysipelas occurred, which prevailed exclusively in close proximity to the South Branch to the main river. The great amount of animal refuse thrown into the South Branch was supposed to have been the cause of this epidemic. Dr. Willis O. Nance, trustee of the Sanitary District, reported in his study, The Sanitary District of Chicago, Its Influence on Chicago's Health, that in 1891, Chicago lost over 1,900 citizens by death from typhoid and had at least 15,000 more cases, and that the death rate from typhoid in that year was 174 per 100,000. The back of the yards, home of Bubbly Creek, was originally part of the town of Lake. The city was sparsely settled prior to the Civil War, but eventually developed and grew with the industrial developments in the Chicago's Union Stockyards. Louise Carroll Wade's seminal history of Packingtown points out that the nuisances created by the packing and related industries in Chicago, in other words, slaughtering and rendering, resulted in the issuance of city ordinances in 1849, 1851, and 1865. According to Wade, when the 1849 and 1851 ordinances failed, the city turned to the state legislature and, in February 1865, secured an act to provide sanitary measures and regulations for the city of Chicago. Wade's work fails to mention another and extremely lengthy ordinance, 18 sections, an ordinance concerning nuisances that was passed by the city in December 1862 before it turned to the state for help. Section 5 of the 1862 ordinance established a financial penalty between $25 and $100 for any distiller, tanner, butcher, pork, or beef packer, or any persons whatsoever who shall cause or suffer any offal, manure, or rubbish to be discharged out of or flow from their premises into the Chicago River or either of its branches or any of its slips or canals connected therewith or into Lake Michigan within the jurisdiction of the city. On November 27th, 1865, the city of Chicago filed the ordinance ordered to remove all rendering establishments from the city limits after the state act was created. This was followed by the passing of the city of an ordinance concerning slaughtering within the limits of the city of Chicago. Together, these acts prohibited slaughters, packers, and renderers from putting offensive matter into the Chicago River or any of its branches, canals, or slips. These ordinances arose because city officials felt that the disposal practices of these industries were destructive of the health of our citizens and are a good source of arrogance to the people generally. Numerous complaints from citizens and city workers about the environmental pollution produced by these industries, which were referred to as nuisances, were filed with the city of Chicago. These complaints gave rise and support to the creation and the ordinances that attempted to regulate these environmental nuisances. The ordinances were inspired and driven by the concerns of the medical community in the newly emerging field of public health, who believed that there was a definite link between cholera, typhoid fever, and the improper management of human and animal waste. The power relations involving the public health officials, who were primarily medical doctors, were not the classical disciplinarian powers articulated by Foucault, but were the beginning of a new form of power that Foucault referred to as biopolitics. Biopolitics emerged as a means of controlling a multiplicity of men, not as individual bodies, but a global mass affected by overall processes, characteristics of birth, death, and production and illnesses. According to Foucault, biopolitical power is a power that seeks control over human beings and their environment, the milieu in which they live. Furthermore, the actions of physicians as public health officials in this situation were typical of the actions Foucault ascribed to biopolitical power. In this case, biopolitical power sought to reduce the mortality rates of Chicago citizens stemming from the environmental degradation of the drinking water source that had been caused by the sewage contamination. Thousands of people had to be protected. The only way to achieve this goal was to regulate and eventually eliminate the source of the environmental contamination, which came from the disposal practices of the Packers. On July 12, 1865, 22 citizens filed a resolution ordering the Board of Police to send a health officer to 188 Wells Street to abate the nuisance of the stench coming from the packing house. The resolution pointed out that the citizens' complaint stemmed from the fact that the packing house was also being used for rendering, which caused a stench that is intolerable. Prior to and in support of the 1862 ordinance, the city's Committee on Health filed its own report based on a 5-week study of the packing house industry. The report on Committee on Health on the nuisances produced by distilleries and slaughterhouses on the South Branch concluded that although there were many businesses that operated hygienically, there were also many who were found pouring their blood and offal, most if not all, into the river. This report also contained statements from over a dozen of its inspectors. Many of these statements were similar to that of inspectors Culbertson and Jones, who observed, "These parties are running their filth and blood into the water. Their house is located on the creek, and the water at this place is red with blood." Similarly, Inspector Troutman remarked that at the gut cleaning place, he is running all his filth into a creek. The condition of his place is awful. The environmental conditions of both Lake Michigan and the Chicago River prior to the reversal of the river in 1900, as discussed in Chapter 3, were in the same as those of Bubbly Creek. According to the testimony given by civil engineer George M. Windsor on behalf of the Sanitary District of Chicago against the United States, the waters were filthy, dirty, sewage-polluted water in a septic condition with gas bubbles rising, having large cakes of floating sewage mud. This mud was held at the surface by the gas being generated by it. It was a disgrace to a civilized community. The waste generated by industries, especially by the packing industries, combined with a rapidly increasing metropolitan area, resulted in the city of Chicago being granted permission by the state to deepen the Illinois and Michigan I&M Canal in order to divert more of the sewage from the Chicago River, and this was completed in 1871. With the initial reversal of the Chicago River. By the late 1880s, the original sewage system and the deepening of the I&M Canal was recognized as being insufficient to handle or keep pace with the waste generated by the packers and the growing population. In 1889, the Sanitary District of Chicago was created to provide complete diversion for Chicago sewage. The district was never limited to the city of Chicago, and its inception included territory outside the border of the city proper. And since 1889, more and more territory has been added until it embraces a considerable portion of Cook County, including parts of all of 61 communities. The formation and implementation of the sanitary district resulted in the development of the Sanitary Ship Canal, whose primary engineering objective was to permanently reverse the flow of the Chicago River so the water would have sufficient volume and kinetic energy to treat sewage. By the end of the second decade of the 20th century, the Chicago Sanitary District, the metropolitan institution responsible for water management, would find itself embroiled in several federal lawsuits based upon the pollution produced by the Packers. The legal fight involving multiple states, Missouri, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Louisiana, and the international community was rooted in the amount of water being taken to treat the sewage problem generated by the human population and the Packers in the Chicago metropolitan region. The following letter, written by the chief engineer to the Sanitary Board of Trustees in the Report on Industrial Waste from the Stockyards in the Packing Town in Chicago, 1921, the Sanitary District of Chicago, illuminates the gravity of the situation. In view of the injunction suit now pending in the federal court to determine our right to take diluting water from Lake Michigan over and above 4,167 cubic feet per second, and the diversion controversies, both national and international, and the condition of the Illinois River, which is steadily growing worse, in large part because of the spurt in the packing industry, I urge that your honorable board of trustees make every effort to arrive at a formal agreement with the packers and stockyards' interests so that actual work can be started upon a constructive plan. For many years, tons of material has been thrown away as useless by packers. I hope soon, with the cooperation of all concerned, that a notable step towards utilization can be made and a commercial fertilizer produced from the material now polluting our main channel and the Illinois River. Respectfully submitted, Albert W. Dilling, Chief Engineer. Dilling's report goes on to state that the Packers' effort to reuse and recycle enough of the animal waste continued to be insufficient to reduce the environmental load in the form of sewage for the ship canal. This situation exacerbated the condition of Bubbly Creek. Dilling lamented that there is still much material which passes away, in the aggregate several thousand tons a year, to which the practical manufacturer attaches little importance. To the sanitary engineer, these wastes containing large amounts of suspended matter with a liquid highly putrescible are of great importance. The sewage generated by the stockyards grew along with the expansion of the yards, but the receiving waters, the Chicago River and its branches, remain constant. The waste generated by the packing industries in the Union stockyards contributed substantially to the treatment load handled by the sanitary district and the death of Bubbly Creek. In 1920, the total load on the main channel was approximately 4.5 million, 1 million from Packingtown, approximately 2.8 million from total population of the sanitary district, 370,000 from Corn Products Refining Company at Argo, and other miscellaneous industries, 400,000. The water pollution problems of the stockyards arose not only because of the amount of solid waste produced from handling human waste, but also because of the enormous amount of waste generated from storing, killing, and processing the livestock relative to the mass of the receiving waters. This is why many sanitary engineers of standing at that time felt the legal actions that had to be brought against them. The sanitary engineers recognized that the reversal of the Chicago River had not completely solved the environmental problems of the area in its entirety. Their testimonies in all of the court depositions made it quite clear that the reversal of the river had in fact worsened the environmental conditions in the back of the yards in ways that it had not anticipated. In effect, the reversal of the river had decreased the kinetic energy of the Bubbly Creek so much that it became an almost inert, foul pool of water. Since the waste pouring into the stream continued to flow from the stockyards without a substantial increase in volume in the receiving waters, in other words, Bubbly Creek, it began to accumulate and become fetid as the aerobic content of the water rapidly declined. This decaying and immobile animal waste pose health hazards for the region, which sanitary engineers felt could only be reduced at that time by increasing the volume of water drawn from Lake Michigan. The creek became so static from the decaying waste that local animals were frequently seen walking across water. The Chicago River's reversal had an immediate and positive impact on improving the environmental health of the most affluent residents or more fortunate citizens of Chicago. The reversal, however, led to the least fortunate residents of in the back of the yards bearing the inequitable costs of this improvement from both environmental and public health perspectives. Burying bubbles, the power relations of non-navigable waters. The final fate of Bubbly Creek would be determined by the Chicago River congressional hearings conducted before the subcommittee of the Committee on Interstate and Foreign Commerce in the House of Representatives, 67th Congress, on December 15, 1921, May 19, 1922, and October 6 and 7, 1922. The subcommittee was formed to decide whether the creek was a non-navigable water as articulated by House Bills H.R. 9049 and H.R. 8648 and Senate Bill S. 3177. The bulk of the testimonies heard by the subcommittee that would influence its decision would occur at the October meeting, which was held in Chicago, Illinois, at the Federal Building. Of the 32 witnesses who testified at the Chicago River hearings in October 1922, 12 represented the business and industrial sector, claiming they were representing civic interests. 13 witnesses were engineers employed by various levels of government, and 7 were attorneys representing business interests. Given these statistics, it is clear that the fate of Bubbly Creek was heavily determined by the power relation that revolved around business power knowledge and engineering power knowledge. Although the Chicago Daily News in 1937 would proclaim that the Irish lick Bubbly Creek, now they can go to the zoo, the historical record is clear that the death of the creek had very little to do with the environmental protests of immigrants in the back of the yards. Rather, it was due in large part to the powering maneuvering of predominantly native white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, WASP men, especially engineers. This group would act first in the economic interests of the state and federal government of the Illinois Deep Waterway Project, and finally in the economic interests of the city of Chicago to complete Pershing Road as the optimal thoroughfare to facilitate and complement economic growth occurring on the city's south side under the guidance of the City Beautiful Plan.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. That was our first audio segment. Packing them in, we will pick up the second audio segment. Starts with the subsection Civic Power and Knowledge. Slowly moving towards the end, almost there. Hopefully everyone is surviving the so-called shutdown, self-distancing, quarantine, whatever you would like to label it. Dr. Welsing would say reading is more important than watching television. Hopefully we can use some of this time to flip a few pages or swipe a few pages, whatever it's going to be. Anything other than just, you know, stream on to the next episode or movie or whatever it's going to be. We have other things that are far more important than TV viewing. We'll have lots of time for that once things are back to normal. In the meantime, the number to dial 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-#. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Before I get to some of the folks who dialed in to share content, I will share one of the emails that we got from folks who are listening in. If you are listening to the archives and have a thought as we get close to the conclusion of packing them in, environmental racism, what you've learned in the text, you can drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com and we can share your thoughts on the air as well. Let's see. All right. It's an email. All righty. Person that wrote in. Greetings, Gus. The reading discussed the work of environmental activist and suspected racist Mary McDowell. The author accurately characterized the power of these women. Quote, although middle class and upper middle class native white women did not hold or wield the same type of power as their male counterparts, they were part of the power relations in Chicago. In opposition to said activism were the wealthy suspected racists Olive and Dolly Leach. This power struggle between them is an example of Neely Fuller's principle that racists are on both sides of any argument in a system of racism, white supremacy. Number two, the author analyzes the poisoning of Bubbly Creek through the philosophy of Foucault. According, also a suspected racist, according to the text, the obvious atrocity had to be validated by the truths of engineers and scientists before the legal action could be taken. According to Foucault, power works in tandem with knowledge. In a system of white supremacy, what is truth? What is knowledge? Truth and knowledge, I suppose, is whatever racist man, racist woman, racist child determine it to be. Mm-hmm. Number three, the nearly 70-year history of disputes over what to do with Bubbly Creek by racist man and racist woman exemplified the system of white supremacy. The seemingly interminable time, energy, and expense put into arguing over what to do trivialized the damage that was done to the countless people harmed by its poisonous waters. Number four, Chicago politicians known as aldermen were mentioned several times in the text. I am interested to learn if any of the Chicago listeners can provide any insights on this unique system. The recently elected mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, reportedly wants to reform it. I appreciate the comments of you and the callers. Much obliged. I don't know if the investor, person who wrote this commentary, when we read, or actually we've done a lot on Chicago. Now, some of this is discussed when we read Dreams from My Father, President Obama. Now, that's 2012, because he talks a lot about the election of Harold Washington. This comes up again when in the book club when we read Leonida McLean's A Foot in Both World, or A Foot in Each World. Which is all about Chicago. She was a black journalist. Unfortunately, she committed suicide. But she wrote quite a bit about politics and the election of Harold Washington, first black mayor of Chicago in the 1980s. And so she talked a lot about their alderman system because it is kind of unique. I don't think they have that in most parts of the world, much less parts of the country. But yeah, they certainly don't use that title other places, I don't think, or at least not too many other places. But she does talk about that system. I remember her talking about one of the aldermen was Mr. Doliak, and he was suspected racist, who was greatly opposed to former Mayor Harold Washington, and the name of his gang of white aldermen. They did the same thing that they were going to do to President Obama. We want to see him fail. Was the Doliak 24, I think. They had some sort of cool name for all of the whites in that
branch of Chicago Power. They had their little nickname, who had it out for Mr. Washington. But yeah, if we have any of our listeners, our spectacular, hardworking narrator, Henry in Chicago, who would not be deterred, coronavirus, China disease, or no, he would not be deterred. Got the recording in, Johnny on the spot. Bravo for doing outstanding professional work as usual. But yeah, maybe he might know. He's been there. I think we have at least some other folks who have resided in Chicago or visited or might just have information about their little unique political system. Folks can feel free to share. Anyway, the number again is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. All righty, let's see. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. I will keep an eye on the switchboard.
Yeah. Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry in Chicago.
All right, greetings, Gus. To the callers and narrators, greeting as well. To the callers and listeners, I'm sorry, greetings as well. what you were just mentioning about the what they call the council wars. So when Harold Washington became mayor, unfortunately, the city council was not in his favor. The guy you were referring to was Edward Doleac. To me, he's not a suspected racist. He is a racist. But he was the head of this council war of 29 aldermen versus 21, who always voted down on his bills. But, you know, it's an interesting time. I don't know if you want me to go into more detail on it, but there was some political genius by Harold Washington in that whole council war thing in the second term. But in regards to the text, though, the previous email that you had read, the power of white women. I mean, even though they don't have the same power as their white male counterparts, but they still hold, you know, like the author said, some kind of power relation in the system of white supremacy. So it is interesting. While I was, you know, narrating, I was thinking about, you know, the term you always say, racist man, racist woman, and racist child, and how much women, black women, wield the type of power. Even though, with the racist Mary McDowell, even though she didn't get exactly what she wanted, she still made some sort of headway in regards to having some sort of legislation or at least some research done in regards to the pollution that was happening with the white immigrant Europeans that were being environmentally terrorized. I think that's all I have right now. I'm getting my line.
Much obliged. Bravo again. Outstanding work. Super professional. Johnny on the spot. No excuses. I couldn't get my ventilator to work and we ran out of toilet paper. I couldn't do the Johnny on the spot. Quarantine or no. It is a grand study. Chicago, any of the cities that are kind of important in the system of white supremacy, like Chicago, is a great one to pick. Atlanta would be a good one to pick. New York City would be a good one to pick. I'm just picking U.S. ones right now, but I mean, pick any city that is, you know, kind of important in terms of dictating things that are going to happen in the city and system of white supremacy. Chicago is a great choice. And I remember when we read Leonida McLean's book, she goes into a lot of detail about all those folks, because it was just like what happened with President Obama, except on a smaller scale. I remember Thomas in New York, he said that frequently. He was with us when we read that text. And he kept saying that because it's like, man, this is exactly what they did to damn Obama, except it's just on a city scale, a local scale, with former Mayor Harold Washington, who died from a heart attack after Alderman Doleac and the rest of his gang got done with him. He didn't even live very long. That's Chicago politics, Windy City. Other folks who dialed in, if you have thoughts to share on the first portion of the reading, proceed. Let's see, they might be taking a few moments to get their thoughts together. I'll share a few of my notes while people get it together. Let's see here. So I think we started last week with Miss McDowell, suspected racist, and her efforts. And I think when I first started hearing her last week, I was like, wait a minute, I think this is a white woman. And I kept going, I was like, maybe I didn't hear that correctly. And I went back and flipped and I said, well, I'll keep listening too. Maybe I got confused, but I think this is a white woman. And I kept listening. I was like, yeah, because she seems a little too active. Like, she's getting all this stuff done. And, you know, she didn't even get everything she wanted, like you said. But, I mean, I don't think they would be allowing all this from a black female at this time. Maybe not even now, 2020. So, yeah, I'm just white women, racist man, racist woman, racist child, system of racism. Let's see. I'm at the end of the notes that I took for this section. I'll scroll back up a little bit further here. I will say, I do think that that's significant as well, that we're reading a book where she does make an effort, talking about Dr. Hood, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington. She does make an effort to point out where black people themselves have recognized that there were problems and tried as best they could to fight back and deal with these issues. But it does seem like there are quite a few snippets where the activities of these ethnic white people, white women, their efforts to deal with all of this. And I think that's important just because, and even though she's, you know, laid out her reasoning for why, because some of these folks are conditional white or not quite white, almost white, trying to get white type of thing, which I totally understand. I think that's important, worthwhile for understanding how the system works in terms of racial classification. Some of that even came up this week as well. But if black people are in that weak of a position that they're not able to, they're not even able to get to the McDowell type positions of activism because they're in such a weak position and they can be abused and beaten down so easily. And then we come back and, you know, have some of those critiques that we had earlier of Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. Whew, man, power dynamics. She talked a lot about power this week. And I mean, wow, that should be. Make it clear the weak power position that black people are in relation to everyone in the system of racism, white supremacy. But go into, well, actually, let me not skip because she has this book. She has the references right at the end of each chapter. So most of the time you'd have to, you know, flip all the way to the end of the book and kind of keep a reference point there so you can kind of go back and find the footnotes and all that. You don't have to do this here. It's right at the end of the chapter, so you don't have to go all the way to the end. She gave a footnote for Thomas Philpott's book, The Slum and the Ghetto, Neighborhood Deterioration and Middle Class Reform in Chicago. This was published in 1978. Might be one if people want to do a little more digging. I think especially folks, if you are residents of Chicago or have some connection to that city, might be one that you want to dig on a little bit more. All right. All the way gender, technology, and environmental justice. I felt like this whole section, too, was mostly focused on white women, the so-called ethnic females, Miss McDowell, and their effort. A lot of times we talk about that when people start talking about gender, they mean females, frequently white women. She says, when she talked about, for me, this is 94 and 93, she says, for decades, Mary McDowell, her contemporaries, and the immigrant women, white, or soon to be white, in the backyards waged battles for environmental justice in their community. They protested, petitioned government officials, and found ways to get their story in the news media. Not going to listen to the Negro. All of this historical evidence shows that they felt that there was sufficient evidence to demonstrate that these immigrants were victim of both the not in my backyard attitude and what I have termed the put it in immigrants' backyards syndrome. And I thought it would be most accurate. There definitely has to be put it in the niggers' backyard, front yard, on top of them, like anything you can think of as it relates to black people. And that applies, you know, 2020. That'll apply even after they get done with the COVID thing, the China disease. On the same page, two paragraphs down, she says, from the environmental standpoint, the greatest contribution of settlement workers like Mary McDowell to immigrant communities was the assimilation of their latter generations to the point where they could be accepted as white and gain access to healthier living spaces if they so choose. Who would not choose to get healthier living conditions? Everybody would pick that. Let me get the hell out of here. I want, you know, great grocery store. I don't want to have all this foul smelling stuff around me and slaughterhouse odor, and they've messed up everything and you can't grow any fruits or veggies or have a little victory garden out next to your house. I don't want to live out here. But that I thought was so crucial. She said, make sure I get the greatest contribution. The greatest contribution was the assimilation of their latter generations to the point where they could be accepted as white. That is their greatest contribution. Not all this environmental work, not trying to clean up the river and get clean air and clean. Being accepted as white. Worthy of a pause, I think. Let's see. Next page. Oh, that was basically the end of that. That was a great point to end on. Great, great to end the chapter. Make a good point. All right, so engineering and environmental inequality, the rise and fall of the notorious Bubbly Creek. That is chapter 4. Folks can share a thought. She opens with that sentence from Michel Foucault, and she quotes him frequently throughout the book. As I said, he's like, I think he's a French. I'll double check, make sure I'm not being incorrect. But I think he's like a French author, political scientist, philosopher. If you're in any of those doctrines, disciplines in the academy, philosophy, political science, you'll probably have to read some Foucault, probably English too, and write a paper on him. But what do people make of that? She starts with this sentence: all forms of power draw some authority by referring to scientific truths, and scientific truths is in quotes. Reminded me of eugenics was the first thing I thought of, if I was being truthful. And the second thing I thought of was pseudoscientific bullshit. Timothy, don't drink the Kool-Aid wise. But what do people, I'll read it again. All forms of power draw some authority by referring to scientific truths in quotes. Further down on that page, she writes, an example of this power-knowledge dynamic occurred in July 1998 in Grand Bois, I think it is, B-O-I-S, Louisiana, when Uma Indians and Cajuns lost a battle for environmental justice against the oil industry because they failed to provide truths, in quotes, that could convince the court that their health problems stemmed from the industrial operations and waste management practices of the Campbell, Wells, and Exxon oil companies. And I'll just stop right there, like, wow, Exxon and all of the damage that they have wreaked up in these parks with the Alaska oil spill, and then BP down in the Gulf region had the big spill, like, man. But that's not even the reason that I highlighted. The reason I highlighted that portion was because that knowledge and power, it reminded me in the book that we just read, Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste, the late, great Johnny Cochran, where he was talking about the folks that he represented in Alabama, Anniston. And he said they come along 30 years later after they've killed, you know, who knows how many thousands of black people or tens of thousands, and have got cancer and ruined their health and their offspring's health and their grandchildren's health. And they say, oh, man. We just did a study, and it looks like you all have gotten the worst possible cancer, and you've been getting it for the last 30 years. Look at this here test. We just spent $10,000, and we've been running this test here, and it says, yeah, this is why your children have been born with three toes. We figured it out. And they'll say, you come to the court and you don't have a $10,000 study. You didn't get to sit down and get all these degrees and do all this. You just come and say, hey, it stinks over here. It's horrible. I see them dumping stuff. This is terrible. It's terrible for our health. It's look here. We don't just take lip from a coon. Do you have a study? Do you have some supporting data? you have an expert? And if you don't, then get out of here. We don't just take coon talk. You just come in here and run off at the mouth telling us anything. We need scientific data. That was a major point, unless my memory is bad, from a terrible thing, to waste. We just finished. Top 10. Next page, she writes, let's see, Bubbly Creek, the major source of environmental health problems and the ultimate sink for most environmental waste in the back of the yards, was originally located in the town of Lake. Its environmental state was strongly influenced by the power relations that existed among the packing house industry, civic, commercial, political, and engineering leadership in Chicago, the state of Illinois, and the federal government, powerful white governing bodies. Despite local ordinances and state and federal laws, the marginally controlled waste disposal practices of the packing houses, slaughterhouses, and tanning industries corrupted the environmental integrity of the creek. Now, as Paul, I highlighted that for a number of reasons. One, when they said the tanning industries, I was thinking of like skin tanning, but I suspect that's not what they were talking about. I suspect they were talking about leather tanning, which is almost kind of the same kind of thing. Dr. Welsing would probably have a lot to say about that, like ruining the environment to tan leather. I suspect that's what that is. If I'm ignorant and you all think it's something else, particularly for this time period, I suspect that's got to be what that is. Tanning animal hides, animal skins, for leather, that sort of thing, which is still Welsing moment. If you are feeling some type of way about your skin not being adequate, melanin deficient, then you need to get some dark skin from an animal, cannibalize it, and then you can wear it and cover up your skin that you think for some reason is not quite adequate. The late great Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, heard her voice before we went live today. But then they make these rules. That is standard in the system of racism. They make these rules. So you got federal rules, you got state rules, you got the EPA, you got all these governing bodies about what you're supposed to be doing. Now, hey, when you slaughter those cows and pigs, and we got to have bacon and yum, 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 and all the rest of it, but it's supposed to be rules about how you go about doing it. They get real selective about when they want to enforce these rules. How often do they want to enforce these rules? How strict do they want to be about these rules? They get real selective about that. So discretion, they call it, when it's white people that are not following the rules. Now, let it have been a whole bunch of black people that had thought, oh, man, ticket writing time, you didn't chop the hog, you didn't do it on a Tuesday at the correct time, that's going to be a $10,000 fine. Oh, yeah. Shutting your slaughterhouse down. I mean, system of racism, white supremacy. That is power too, right there. If you want to talk about power and knowledge, power to decide when something is a crime and when something is not a crime. That a lot of times comes down to power as well, not morality and who is behaving correctly. I'll pause there. Any other folks dialed in with a hand up have comments that they wanted to share? First audio segment from Packing the Men this week.
Can I be heard?
Our narrator, Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'd be interested to know more about these leech women, because they seem to have some sort of, like, on page 100, we're talking about how Olive Leach was a graduate of the Chicago Law School, and she's some kind of lawyer. And these women had filed a lawsuit against the Chicago Junction Railway for $2 million, which at the time probably was a lot more if you look at inflation, because that was 1934. So I'm pretty sure $2 million is like, $60 million or, $80 million or whatever right now. But, I would like to know more about what these women were about. I mean, they're probably, they're white women, and I just wanted to understand how much, because I guess in this part of the book, they were kind of opposed to Bubbly Creek being destroyed, saying that they were saying that Bubbly Creek was actually navigable because they had property in back of the yards and probably was contributing to the environmental terrorism of the, European immigrants that were in the area. So be interested to find some information on these two race soldiers and see what they were all about. That's all I had.
Reading is more important than watching television. I was thinking the same thing because I don't know, or I had never heard of who these folks are. The same thing with McDowell, Mary McDowell. I'd never heard of who she was either. Just, you know, who are these chicks? What were they doing? What was, you know, their struggle? Like, just to get a little bit more information. I always think that that's important in the system of racism. And just to get more details, like I said, a lot of times they, you know, will tell us that these white chicks are so weak and victims and helpless in the system. And they're just being pulled around and beaten around by these white male ogres. And frequently, in my opinion, that is not the case. So, yeah. Let's see. Other folks who are with us, if you have a hand up and we have not heard from you at all, if you have comments to share, proceed. I reckon other folks maybe are still pondering, getting their thoughts together for the first.
Can you hear me?
Oh, Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. You can hear me now. I was talking, but I don't think I could be heard. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers, right poorly. All power derives from scientific evidence, you said, Gus?
Let's see. It's all forms of power draw some authority by referring to scientific truths, end quotes.
Yeah, I think instead of saying draw some authority, if you change that and said justification, they use that as their justification. Like you said, eugenics. That all sciences are based and built on the premise of the initial Darwinist theory, then therefore they're all trying to prove it. So they're all supported, you know, scientifically. So that's always their go-to. Well, it's scientifically true, you know, but you can't prove that, you know, because it was based off a lie to start with. So, yeah, I definitely agree, but they also use religion as a justification mechanism too. You know, they're the chosen people. He was just talking about Exxon. You know, at one time, Exxon, ExxonMobil, Texaco, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Marathon Speedway, and BP, which was, when I was a kid, called Amoco, it's all owned by one person, John D. Rockefeller. It was called Standard Oil, and he was forced to split it up into the different brands it is today. So, you know, you could just, if you want to point to environmental racist or environmental person that destroyed the environment more than anyone, you know, you got to look at him. I watched this documentary this week, intrigued by the books we've been reading, and it was a white guy. And he was in Harlem, and he was by the plant that I didn't know existed. That's what caught my eye. And he was testing the water. So I said, interesting, but he jumps into the Hudson River and cut his foot on a rock and found out it was like 250 different parasitic. I mean, it was terrible. And I see black people actually getting that water sometimes. It just, ugh. But very interesting. I think it was on Rice TV. It was on YouTube, but Rice TV. My note. Number one note I took, those weak and powerless white women. The lady married to a banker goes to Europe, learns sewage techniques from the nastiest people in the world, and takes them back to Chicago to implement them. And uses her connections in the press to promote and teach her new sewage practices. And it's pretty successful. Before women could even vote. Leach sisters, who inherited the stockyards and the train yards and probably everything else in certain parts of Chicago and still own it, family. managed to hold up the entire municipality from cleaning bubbly streets for years for these powerless white women. Now, the Chicago River, it can be a canal, used as a canal. It'll take you from Lake Michigan into the Des Plaines River, which will eventually bring you into the Mississippi. And that was part of NAFTA. I don't know if they still have the money allocated to make that happen, but that was a huge reason why there's going to be a lot of gentrification in that whole region of Illinois. How many people lived in Bubbly Creek? They gave the numbers, but I couldn't remember because I don't have the book, so I had to look it up real quick. And it said in 1891, they had 4,300 people die from bronchitis and pneumonia, and another 2,000 people died from typhoid fever. And I said, wow. You know, it shut everything down for 171 deaths of the coronavirus. I mean, you talk about living in deplorable, that's 1 year. So whatever they were breathing in was killing them. But these white women were allowed to hold it up, you know, because they didn't want to lose out on whatever money, I guess, meant or whatever had coming in from that area, just how the system of white supremacy works. White women, that's what I took from this week so far, Gus. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. That would be a good point to take. I've been looking to see if we could get more information on Dolly and Olive Leach, L-E-I-T-C-H. And it looks like they have like court records and things of them online, and even some links to this book pop up, and some of the different court petitions and things that they filed down through the years, but not a definitive, like, hey, you know, these sisters were setting Chicago on fire and that sort of thing, like, to just give more like a biographical sketch of their life and times type of thing. If I find anything, I will share. But I think that's so important because they tried to blame them, right? Them saying that for years they were, you know, going to do something else with Bubbly Creek. Let's fill it in. This is, you know, a disgrace. It's not navigable. The federal government has recognized that it's not navigable. And these white chicks, they're holding it up. They're holding it up, this whole process. And I even, you know, if these had been black people, males or females, I don't think it would have been. The city of Chicago has plans for this waterway, but these two niggers are holding it up. And in fact, they've been holding it up for decades. We've been trying to get this done. And, you know, at no count, Kanye West is messing it up. Like, what? Like, I couldn't see that now in 2020, like them allowing two black people, President Obama, I couldn't see them allowing him to hold up. We want to do something. We got a major project for the city. And the Obama Library is right in the middle of where we're trying to build it. Like, man, this coon is still messing it up for us. He's not even no, that just does not compute for me. Let's see. I didn't get to all my notes. I'll keep an eye on the switchboard if other folks dial in if you have commentary that you want to get on the first audio segment. I'll keep an eye out before we get to the audio segment number two. Let's see. She goes on about knowledge. She says this scientific and technological validation of water pollution and its environmental consequences by engineers was a classic example of Foucault's thesis that the execution of power works in tandem with knowledge. Leach's assessment supported Foucault's belief that there was no power relation without the correlative constitution of a field of knowledge, nor any knowledge that does not presuppose and constitute at the same time power relations manifested in the battle to have Bubbly Creek declared non-navigable. In this case, it was the engineering power knowledge that facilitated the power relations needed to destroy the creek and eliminate an environmental nuisance that disproportionately impacted Eastern European immigrants living in the back of the yards. Despite the legal power and science power that the Leaches brought into the power relationship, no doubt their gender impacted the saliency and acceptability of their argument. I guess that could be, but I mean, that for me, that part of it at the conclusion there makes it a little bit weak. You can't on the one hand say that these chicks got blamed for holding this property and holding it up, and people had other ideas about what they wanted to do here, and they just botched up the whole process for decades even. You can't say that and then come back and say, well, because they were women, people didn't listen to them or their argument didn't have the same power. Well, how did they mess this all up? If people had other plans for what they wanted to do and then blame them and said that they were the ones to hold it up, how was that? That just seems a little bit contradictory. I think that in my opinion, that happens regularly. That is hallmark, where people make these contradictory arguments because they consistently, everybody, non-white people, we all do it. It must be a part of the conditioning of the system. We minimize the role and power that white women have in this system. So we'll come back to find these different ways of, well, they aren't listened to, or they don't vote, or something to try to, you know, minimize their role in the system. Those things may be true, that maybe they couldn't vote at this particular point in time, or maybe they don't make quite as much money as a white man. That does not mean they do not influence, exert power in this system. And in my opinion, at minimum, equal. You might be able to find different statistics here and there and blah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, that white man, whatever he makes, has got to go back to the white woman supporting the white family. Let's see. Other notes before... See, this is 104. She writes, in his 1869 report to the Illinois State Board of Health, Dr. John H. Rauch, sanitary superintendent of the city of Chicago, would state that the amount of sewage generated by slaughterhouses by 1863 had grown so large that it had become equal to or exceeded the amount produced by the human population. As a result, the city's sewage system could not keep up with this production, and in 1863, a remarkable epidemic of erysipelas occurred, which prevailed exclusively in close proximity to the South Branch and to the main river. I'll stop there. Cows Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat, Toronto, border reopened. May 21 through May 24 will be in Washington, D.C., August 5th through the 9th, plant-based yoga retreat. I don't think you have to worry about the amount of feces generated from growing cauliflower or broccoli or Brussels sprouts. I don't hear any conversations about methane gas and flatulence. If we're growing asparagus and tomatoes, I have not heard about that. And having all of this waste having to be dumped into the river from growing peanuts. I have not heard all of that. Plant-based. Better for everybody. Better for the environment. Better for our bodies. Don't have all this pollution. Takes up less resources. Much better all the way around. Incidentally, I think they hear a lot of that today. North Carolina, they talk about that with the pigs and all that waste. And predictably, it will do so in a manner where the runoff and the waste and the smell and all that will disproportionately impact the black people at the back of the yards. That's the name that they have. Again, the bottoms. That's one of the spots they have in Oakland. The bottoms. The back of the yards. All these goofy names. Africaville. Niggertown. Any other notes? Let's see. On 107... The district was never limited to the city of Chicago, and its inception included territory outside the borders of the city proper. And since 1889, more and more territory has been added until it embraces a considerable portion of Cook County, including parts or all of 61 communities. The formation and implementation of the sanitary district resulted in the development of the sanitary ship canal, whose primary engineering objective was to permanently reverse the flow of the Chicago River so water would have sufficient volume and kinetic energy to treat sewage. This was another one where I thought Urugu. Playing God. I know what we'll do. This will be great. Let's reverse the flow of the river. And it turns out that just makes everything 1,000 times worse, makes the river totally stagnant, and has now stacked up all of this putrid waste and filth. And then it develops a crust and hardens so that animals can now walk across the river. I mean, Dr. Kamal Kamban has stated repeatedly, racist man, racist woman, racist child, they turn the entire planet into a giant cesspool of filth. That's what we are in. That right there. And they just said this week it would have been, hey, let's turn the river green. I know. Yeah, we messed up before. Okay. We won't reverse the flow of the current. I know. We won't do that anymore. We'll just turn it green. How about that? Can we just leave it natural? They said in Italy this week, I've never been. Look at that. I just got my passport, and then days after I get my passport, they close the border. They said in Italy this week, I've never been. Might never get to go now. They said they showed one of their famous waterways, and you could see the fish. The water was crystal clear. And they said people that live there, they said, man, I haven't seen fish in this water like ever. Because they said it's been really hard hit and everybody's on quarantine and all that. You can't go out like for real. They said it cleaned the whole water out. There is an infection on the planet. Absolutely. I don't know about the China disease. I don't know about the China virus. I don't know about that. I'm not sure. They still got some skepticism about that. One that I am sure of, the scourge, the infection of white supremacy racism, racist man, racist woman, racist child, absolutely messing up the planet for decades, centuries. Anything else? Make sure. They even have some pictures in this portion of the book this week where they start to show some of the different chemical and biological warfare and plants spewing all kinds of nonsense out into the world. The stockyards and slaughterhouses. Yeah, I guess that's it. Civic power. That was all my notes I have for this week. Other folks that are with us, anything else they want to share? First audio segment before we get to the second portion of the reading.
You know, what was interesting was this headline from the Chicago Daily News, the Irish Lick Bubbly Creek, now they can go to the zoo. And I guess this was the time when the Irish wasn't considered quote-unquote white at the time. So goes to show you, you know, how they thought about the Irish, because I'm pretty sure if those were non-white black people, that the headline would have probably been Niggers Lick Bubbly Creek, now they can be in the zoo. So, but I mean, it's still, you know, degradation to the Irish at the time who were considered not white. And also, too, in this segment between page 111 and 110, when Dr. Washington was talking about how the Bubbly Creek incident became how they buried it in regards to not because of environmental reasons, but more economic reasons. And, you know, it's always interesting how white people like to package things in the interest of economics. You know, they always have this thing where, you know, well, we're creating more jobs. You always hear, you know, President Trump talking about how unemployment in the black community has gone down, yada, yada, yada. But it's always cased in economics. Nothing about environment, nothing about our safety, just economics. And this is what, you know, politicians, especially white politicians, do when they pander to black people to vote for them. I can get you more jobs. I can get you, you know, more money. I can get you $1,000 check, you know, whatever. So this is what they think of us. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting thing that I kind of pointed out. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago, doing the heavy lifting, narrating the text.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Well, one thing to Henry, you know, remember this about the Irish, so, and to everyone. They went from being discriminated against and treated with bias and prejudice by other white people at one time at the turn of the century, but by the 1960s, they had a president in the White House, you know. So, you know, how long did it take us to get one of those? 400 years almost, you know. So, I mean, they stepped up pretty quick once they got called white. You know, it was that fast for them. Also, the at CERN, which is the Hadron Collider, another form of racism, white people over in Switzerland, France, 300 miles long under Switzerland and France. And either way, the scientist there, he says, they asked him after doing an experiment and coming out and telling the press what he did. He said, "Are you trying to play God?" And he said, "I don't play." You know, so that was how he answered that question. That's how I think most of these white people think. You know, let's turn the water way around. You know, it's no, you know, we'll go against the grain of what's natural, you know, and use some type of fluid science. They already started from a floor, you know, and do it, you know. So the other thing, the sewage system. So I was watching the thing about the guy who got in the water, and he goes to the sewage plant, which is right here in Harlem, only one in Manhattan, in Harlem. You look at them in Brooklyn, all in the black areas. You look at them in Queens, all in the black areas. You look at them in the Bronx, all in the black areas. And then they got a few in Staten Island, which is probably in the middle of nowhere. But either way, all they do to treat this stuff, and I'm thinking Bubbly Creek, is they just put an enzyme, or they take all of the waste, put it together, and then put some enzymes down into it that naturally break it down, some bacterial enzymes. And once it breaks down to a certain consistency, then they're able to flush it into the waterway mixed with bleach. So something that's simple now, probably not simple, but I'm sure that scientists back then had to know there was some bacteria that could have ate through maybe those years and years of flesh and things they put there, but they tried to do reverse engineering the river, doing things that just made it worse. I mean, my line. Thank you, Justin.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Weird science indeed for the city of Chicago. And then again, the same thing with that knowledge. A lot of times with knowledge, they get this information. You don't get this information until way, way later. That's one of the other ways that so-called scientific knowledge works. We have this scientific information. We get it. Maybe we share it with you. Maybe we don't. Maybe we share it with you the same time that we get it. Maybe we don't. I think that's came up with the so-called coronavirus, where they've accused some folks of saying, "Hey, did you know about all this and the shutdowns and everything were going to be coming a month ago?" And not saying anything about it. Like, sometimes we get scientific knowledge and we share immediately. Sometimes we get scientific knowledge and we wait a month or a year or 30 years. Just depends. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they get in?
You know, what's also interesting is that these ordinances and lawsuits that were going on between the city of Chicago and Bubbly Creek with the packing houses was happening in the 1860s. Now, if anybody remembers, you know, their history, this is when the Civil War was going on. So I often thought about that, was like, because this is happening to, you know, they had dates from 1863 and 1865 and 1861. So it's sort of like, you know, while all this is going on, the Civil War is going on. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Indeed. Indeed. That was one of the things that caught my attention when I went to read this book. Like, wow, the dates that she's going back at so far in 1865. Absolutely. The Civil War is still going on in 1865, at least up until this time, 1865. Civil War would have still been going on. So, yeah, that was one of the reasons that I picked the text. That's what I said earlier this week. You know, even in times where you can have extraordinarily important things going on, the worldwide pandemic, Civil War, you will have other things that are happening that are also significant. Now, that might be on the back page, everything on the front page. Oh, my God. Gettysburg and what's going to happen and all the rest. Yeah, that might be important. But on the back page, oh, wow, the slaughterhouses are just messing up the whole river situation in Chicago. Got a lawsuit about that. Wow, that is important. Try to pay attention to that. And I mean, hey, if you live in Chicago, that is way important. Like, we might have to spend 10 minutes on the Civil War, but
We're going to spend a good 15 minutes talking about this water thing. I mean, man, it smells so bad I can't even read about what happened, Battle of Gettysburg or any of the rest of it. It smells so bad out here. Slaughterhouse, it's a game. Plant-based yoga retreat. Eat more veggies. Eat more veggies. Posted my buffalo chicken pizza online today. Posted the amazing pictures of it. You can eat well and not have to eat all the meat. Ruin and be cruel to the animals and then be cruel to the environment. With, like, you do not have to live that way. We can do way better and still eat delicious in 2020. Anything else folks need to get in? We'll assume folks are good for the time being. If you have,
I think this is one of those reasons why older white people try to make it seem like they had it so tough, you know, had it so hard. You know, I don't want to hear what you niggas is talking about, man. When I grew up, we had typhoid. He lived down by the Bubbly Creek. You know, y'all don't know nothing about. And I think that's one of the Archie Bunker type, you know, mindset where, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, not weighing into the equation that at some point you will be white. That's why you have it the way you have it now. But I'm in my line. Thank you.
Very, very common. Absolutely. All the deaths and what have you that they had in Chicago over all of this, absolutely. You don't know how good you all have it now. They could just go around and spray lead willy-nilly and bring all the cows and have them drop a load in your front yard, and there's nothing you could do about it. Just had to live through it as best we can. Like, you don't know how good you got it right now. Absolutely. Here, I feel like I hear and see a lot of that type of attitude from folks on a regular basis. Should be striving to do way better. We can do way better than what we have now. None of this is anything to brag about. Not what we have in 2020. Probably not what we have in 2021. It could be way, could and should be way, way better. That's it. We'll go ahead and get to the second audio segment, Packing Them In, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington. So we're picking up, the subsection is Civic Power and Knowledge. If you didn't get to share, you had something else, make a note, and we'll have ample time once this part concludes. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Civic Power and Knowledge. As alluded to by the Leech women, the drive to fill in Bubbly Creek as a critical path to extend Pershing Road was supported and promoted by many individuals, politicians, and business interests who claimed that they were representing civic interests. A consortium of those active in the demise of the creek included the Central Manufacturing District Association, CMD, the Chicago Plan Commission, the Pershing Street Association, the 39th Street Association, the City of Chicago Mayor and Council, United States Congressmen, Illinois State Representatives, Chicago Metropolitan Sanitary District Engineers, City Engineers, and Packingtown Aldermen. All of these entities would provide crucial testimony in the U.S. Congress subcommittee hearings on October 6th and 7th, 1922, that would lead to Bubbly Creek being declared non-navigable water. Although immigrants had complained for years about the environmental state posed by Bubbly Creek, less than 10% of the 32 witnesses who gave testimony at the Chicago River hearings were born outside of the United States, and only one of the witnesses was a woman, Olive Leach. One newspaper account that announced construction on Pershing Road had finally begun that back in the days when Archer Avenue was Archie Road, the Irish, who were among the noisiest, and the rest of the people of the 11th Ward, better known as Bridgeport, were raising a fuss and fume about that auriferous litter appendage of the Chicago River called Bubbly Creek. Illinois State Representative David E. Shanahan, an Irishman, was one of only three ethnic witnesses who testified at the Chicago River hearings on behalf of the community. Shanahan had been a resident of the Packingtown area for 30 years at the time of the hearing, and was a proponent of the efforts to bury Bubbly Creek once it was declared non-navigable water. He testified that he was in favor of the creek being closed for economic reasons, not environmental ones. Our particular interest is to have this street, Pershing Road, open in order that people over here will have an opportunity to go over to their employment in the east end of the city, and that people living in the east end will have an opportunity to go over here to this great industrial district for employment. Illinois Congress Representative John W. Rainey's terse testimony in support of closing the creek concurred with that of Shanahan. Rainey, however, pointed out that the creek had been an environmental problem for the community. At the hearing, he declared, "It is insanitary. It is unhealthful. And all the people out there are very anxious to have it filled in." Although Rainey testified that the creek had been considered an eyesore in the community for years, it had now, more importantly, became an obstacle that stood in the way of much needed transportation route for 100,000 to 150,000 people. Rainey asserted that opening Pershing Road to the other side of the city limits would establish an avenue of transportation for all the laboring people there and for all the employees of the stockyards. Both of these political representatives offered truths that justified the closing of the creek based on the economy. They put very little emphasis on the environmental degradation that had taken place in Bubbly Creek and the concomitant health issues of the community at large. Their goals were to engage in power relations that would support and sustain economic development for the Packingtown community and the city at large. Another important member of this civic consortium was Mary McDowell. Although not a physical witness at the October Chicago River hearing, she heavily influenced the power relations that sought the demise of Bubbly Creek. McDowell was the first woman garbage commissioner of the city of Chicago, and she became known as the Duchess of Bubbly Creek. Her engagement in these power relations was motivated because she felt strongly that at least 3/4 of a mile of Bubbly Creek posed a menace to the health of the surrounding district. Her biography makes it clear that she began her fight to have Bubbly Creek eliminated, beginning with the stockyard strike of 1904, and used her friendship with Admiral Dewey to reach the War Department in an effort to get the national government to fill in Bubbly Creek. On January 15, 1907, 1 year before the Chicago Plan Commission was approved by Chicago voters, McDowell wrote to the Secretary of War Bixby asking for guidance on how to have the creek declared a non-navigable body and filled in to eliminate it as an environmental nuisance. Her letter was offered in the hearings by Olive Leach to help show the court the long-term formation and existence of a consortium of power groups who actively sought out physical destruction of the creek for economic purposes, not for environmental reasons. Leach accused McDowell of being a representative of the stockyards' interests, who purported to be working in the interests of public health. McDowell saw her efforts in influencing individuals and institutions whom she believed held power over the fate of Bubbly Creek as being in the environmental interests of the community, not of the packing houses. In her biography, she described the packing houses as commercial enterprises, not as interested in municipal sanitation as the humanitarian would desire. When McDowell's efforts with the War Department failed to get the creek filled in, she concentrated her efforts on getting rid of the creek through the city's health department and the sanitary district. her commitment to having the creek eliminated, resulting in her taking part of the agitation of the 1927 Bubbly Creek State Bill, SB 74, introduced in the state legislature by Senator Frank McDermott. The bill was strongly supported and endorsed by the South Side Chamber of Congress, who, through its representatives, spent much time at Springfield, Illinois, working for the passage of the Bubbly Creek Bill. This bill met with opposition from the Leach sisters, but passed in June 1927. The bill gave the city of Chicago eminent domain powers, allowing it to fill in Bubbly Creek after it had been declared non-navigable waters. The city's ability to implement the passed state bill and fill in Bubbly Creek would be thwarted and delayed by an injunction filed by Olive Leach and Dora Leach with federal judge James H. Wilkerson, who still contended that Bubbly Creek was a navigable water as defined under the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, subject only to control by the federal government. The resistance of the Leaches to the efforts to fill in the creek persisted even though the federal government had abandoned the creek as a non-navigable waterway. The Central Manufacturing District Association, CMD, was another one of the primary self-described civic forces in the power relations that sought out the physical termination of the creek. The Central Manufacturing District, approximately 300 acres formerly known as the Cabbage Patch property, which was a geographical location within the stockyards, was acquired by the Chicago Junction Railway Company. This was the very same company that would try to use legal power to eliminate the Leach women from the debate over Bubbly Creek. Situated on the south side of Chicago, the CMD was primarily located between 35th and 39th Streets, extending from Morgan Street on the east to Ashland Avenue on the west and portions of Roby Road near 43rd Street. Bubbly Creek became a critical issue for the association because through the center of the district ran the south and west forks of the south branch of the Chicago River. The CMD Club opened in 1912 and was created to fill a very important place in the daily routine life of the businessmen in the Central Manufacturing District. Since Bubbly Creek was in the middle of the district, its business members became actively engaged in the power relations that sought to bury the creek and promote continued economic development in the area, which they felt was contingent on the completion of Pershing Road, formerly 39th Street, as a major transportation route. The continued development of transportation infrastructure was consistent with the objectives of the CMD's owner. From the very beginning, they would claim that splendid roads lead from the district in all directions, making it possible to team freight to all portions of the city at a minimum expense. The CMD was highly aggressive in its political efforts to get rid of Bubbly Creek. It hosted a luncheon for the U.S. congressman who conducted the Chicago River hearing on the very same day of the hearing for the express purposes of influencing the decision to declare the creek a non-navigable waterway. In its own magazine, CMD stated that it hosted the luncheon for several federal congressmen and local and regional politicians at the Central Manufacturing District Club to discuss the matter of the people versus the open sewer. According to the article, every speaker voiced grievances against the obscene rivulet Bubbly Creek, and the meeting went on the record as urging Congress to close Bubbly Creek. The sentiments of the CMD members can be summarized by the comments of County Treasurer P.J. Carr, who said that the river hadn't been worth anything to anybody for 10 years and that it should be closed to make way for a needed improvement, Pershing Road, and that he knew the creek when it was crystal pure, and estimated that now 100,000 workers talk about the odor every day, to the disgrace of Chicago. The article further pointed out that the filling in of the stream is not only advocated by CMD, the Pershing Road Association, and the Council Committee, but by the Chicago Association of Commerce and other civic bodies as well. Immediately following the CMD luncheon, a large percentage of the guests, especially from the Pershing Road Association, walked to the federal building in Chicago to give testimony in the Chicago River hearings. Of the more than 20 witnesses who testified at the Chicago River hearings in support of the closing of Bubbly Creek, one-fifth were members or affiliates of the Pershing Road Association. In his testimony on behalf of the Pershing Road Association, its secretary, Mr. B.H. Heidi, asserted that the organization was associated with the Greater 39th Street Improvement Association, the Oakland Business Association, the Southside Businessmen's Association, the Westside Businessmen's Association, and several other civic organizations, which banded together and formed as its chief mission the building of a road from the lake, Lake Michigan, to the proposed or planned zoological gardens just outside of the western limits of the city of Chicago. The testimony of the president of the Pershing Road Association, Mr. Edward E. Maxwell, was consistent with that of the association's secretary and emphasized economic growth and expansion as the primary reason for filling in the creek. Maxwell pointed out that the matter of physically eliminating large portions of the creek was a question of the greatest good for the greatest number, and this is absolutely essential because that district west of Ashland Avenue is growing very rapidly. It is becoming a very large industrial district all the way west there, and not only industrial, but there are many homes there. The president of the Greater 39th Street Association, Mr. E. A. Munger, testified that his organization was the parent organization of all those who had organized around the closing of Bubbly Creek and the development of Pershing Road, including the Pershing Road Association. The organization had formed between 1904 and 1907 and represented 61 affiliated downtown and Southside clubs with a membership of over 225,000 who unanimously endorsed this proposition. Munger testified that the association had had a long and difficult battle to close the creek and get the street open and had met with every imaginable difficulty that could be devised, beginning with the stockyards and the owners of the property along Bubbly Creek. Munger's testimony also demonstrated his desire to utilize the power of the civic and business community in deciding the fate of the river, as well as elucidating the historical force of this particular issue in power relations in Chicago. His statement during his testimony made it very clear that his organization's position was held and supported by a large number of citizens who also exercised a considerable amount of political power and influence in Chicago. His objective is clearly evidenced by the following statement he made at the hearing. "I want to say further, Mr. Chairman, that there is not now any man in office on the south side of Chicago who was not elected on a platform resolving to close Bubbly Creek and open 39th Street. I do not know what the official sanitary board say through the engineers here, but I know when we go down there, they all stand up on their hind legs and say that they are for it and for it hard." Munger's concern over the weight of the engineering power and knowledge in determining this hearing was well-founded. Engineering power knowledge. The final decision to declare Bubbly Creek as non-navigable water was primarily driven by the engineering power knowledge provided by local, state, and federal engineers during the 1922 congressional hearings. The engineer constituted at least 33% of the 32 witnesses who testified before the subcommittee. The most influential engineering testimony in the hearing was that of Major Rufus W. Putnam, District Engineer of the United States Army Corps of Engineers, and to a lesser extent, that of Mr. A.T. Grohman, Civil Engineer with the U.S. Engineering Office, U.S. Army Corps, in Chicago, Illinois. Major Putnam was from a very prominent and old American military family. His father, William Rice Putnam, was the son of Edwin Putnam, one of the sons of the famous General Rufus Putnam, thus making Major Rufus W. Putnam the great-grandson of General Putnam. Putnam testified that this particular portion of the Chicago River had not been under improvement by the federal government since 1919. Putnam pointed out that the River and Harbor Act of March 2, 1919, definitely abandoned as a project for improvement of all the South Branch of the Chicago River, which included the South Fork up to the Chicago Junction Railway Bridge. Illinois Deep Waterway Project. Although local Chicago media scapegoated the Leach women as being the thorns in the City Beautiful Plan, the real conflict was between state and federal engineers and local planners and engineers in Chicago. This fact was supported by the subcommittee's final decision, which stated that it was a local controversy over closing a river that is strenuously urged by the city of Chicago and the various civic and industrial organizations that appeared in the interest of the city and just as seriously opposed by representatives of the state. The heart of the problem was whether the entire creek, both the southwest and southeast forks of the South Branch of the Chicago River, should be classified as non-navigable and filled in for local highway improvements, in other words, Pershing Road, to support economic development in the city of Chicago, or whether parts of the creek could still be classified as navigable waters. If parts of the creek remain navigable, it would benefit the federally sponsored and endorsed Illinois Deep Waterway Project, which sought to develop a waterway course from Lake Michigan to the Mississippi River. This deep waterway project was planned and designed to support interstate commerce during the waterway routes. Major Putnam testified that the federal government was very interested in the deep waterway project because it had a stake not only in the returns on its $2 million investment in the Illinois River, but in its use as a highway for this possible increased traffic. Putnam's statements supported those of the state's superintendent and chief engineer of the Division of Waterways, C.R. Miller, who was also director of Public Works and Buildings. On behalf of the state, Miller protested against the declaration of all portions of the South Branch as a non-navigable waterway because the state of Illinois is now engaged in improving the Des Plaines River so as to connect the Mississippi River with the drainage canal and Lake Michigan by a 9-foot channel, and $20 million in bonds have been issued by the state for that purpose. The state engineers made it very clear during the hearings that it was very probable that all available navigable portions of the Chicago River will be required to handle the commerce which we are advised will navigate through these waters. The real fight was between Illinois waterways and Chicago highways. Although both interests, city and state, would be served in the long term, the city planners successfully predicted during the hearing that the age of automobile transportation and railway transportation would soon eclipse that of waterway transportation. The power relations in Chicago at this time demanded the interest and involvement of prominent businesses, political and governmental leaders, and institutions, in addition to the civic protests of Packingtown residents, to bring some type of satisfactory closure to the environmental nightmare posed by Bubbly Creek. Industrial activities, especially by the Packers, produced Bubbly Creek, and it was long recognized by everyone in Chicago that industrial leadership, together with governmental leadership, was critical in resolving this particular environmental nuisance in the back of the yards. The decision of the Congressional Subcommittee echoed that belief when they rejected the proponents' first of two arguments for declaring the creek a non-navigable body. The first argument was based on Bubbly Creek being foul, insanitary, and a nuisance to the health of the people in that part of the city. The committee agreed that although the creek had been extremely polluted, the level of pollution had occurred because authorities of the city of Chicago could have prevented it and still could prevent it if they choose to do so. Congress decided to declare Bubbly Creek a non-navigable water only because of the transportation infrastructures needed to support the economic development that the industrial and civic interests had convincingly testified was occurring in the area and specifically in the Central Manufacturing District. Congress made it also very clear in its decision that it was impressed with the great importance of the Deep Waterway Project promoted by the state of Illinois, and it would not recommend the enactment of any legislation that would hinder or embarrass the state of Illinois in the completion of the project. In the end, the Congressional Subcommittee decided that the federal government would relinquish its control over Bubbly Creek to the state of Illinois as a navigable waterway based on the testimony of engineers from the federal and state governments. Its decision was also based on its legal power provided by a precedent that established that it was within the power of Congress to abandon a navigable waterway if it does not think it is wise to extend public funds to improve it. Congress did not merely abandon its right to the state, but urged in the passing of the Senate Bill SB 3177 that the power relations in the state settle the fate of the creek. Congress would declare that it had abandoned control to the end that the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois made themselves freely settle all questions involved. State and municipal political power knowledge. The city of Chicago, the state of Illinois, and the federal government eventually resolved the conflict between Bubbly Creek and the Deep Waterway Project once the federal government had abandoned its authority over the creek as navigable water in 1923. It would take another 14 years of power relations between primarily the municipal and state governments to have Bubbly Creek filled in and Pershing Road completed by 1937. During the 1920s and 1930s, the state of Illinois experienced a decline in waterway traffic. Traffic on the Illinois River in the 1920s totaled only 100,000 to 200,000 annually. In 1933, until the first toll came up from New Orleans, there was no traffic at all between Lockport and Starved Rock. Furthermore, the Army Corps of Engineers decided that the optimal deep waterway route to Lake Michigan would be the Sag Channel, completed between 1911 and 1922. The Corps made this decision because this route would avoid the increasingly congested central Chicago area that had been slowed down with too many lift bridges. A federal act of July 3, 1930, extended the federal project on Illinois waterways to the heads of federal projects in Chicago and Calumet. This same act also transferred control of all the Illinois water projects and the canals of the sanitary district to the federal government. The move to the Sag Channel, as opposed to the sanitary ship canal, helped clear the path for building Pershing Road by removing the south branch of the Chicago River as a viable route to Lake Michigan in the Deep Waterway Project. The delays in building Pershing Road then became driven by legal actions of property owners along Bubbly Creek. some of those owners engaged in legal fights with both the city of Chicago and the state to either halt the destruction of the creek or be properly compensated for the loss of economic opportunities that would occur once the creek was eliminated. Despite these obstacles, the city of Chicago and the Chicago Plan Commission continued to move forward and have Bubbly Creek filled in and Pershing Road completed in 1937. The improvement of Pershing Road had been advocated by the Chicago Plan Commission before the 1923 navigability decision. The street was mentioned in the 11th annual report of the Chicago Plan Commission, 1920, as a street that was critical to improving traffic conditions in the stockyards and to providing residents with access to Lake Michigan and the zoo. In 1921, officers of the Plan Commission appeared before the city council committees in connection with the ordinance for the filling in of Bubbly Creek between Halsted Street and Racing Avenue, necessary for the continuation of Pershing Road. In 1921, Ward 5 Alderman Eaton had presented a resolution that urged the necessity of filling in the West Fork of the South Branch of the Chicago River. In 1925, the Chicago Plan Commission identified Pershing Road as one of the streets in their through traffic street plan that they recommended for the city of Chicago to adopt and implement. According to the Plan of Chicago, 1925, the city's adoption and execution of the through street plan would play a major role in relieving the present condition of congested traffic and in bringing us nearer to a solution of the traffic problem. The 1925 plan specifically recommended that Pershing Road be opened and widened from lakefront to western city limits, a distance of about 8 miles. According to the Chicago Plan Commission reports, the plan for Pershing Road remained stagnant and in status quo from 1922 through 1927. This was probably due to the fact that it was not until 1927 that the state of Illinois, through the passage of the Bubbly Creek Bill, would grant the city of Chicago the right of eminent domain to fill in the creek and develop the road. In 1928, the Chicago Plan Commission's Executive Committee appointed a Pershing Road Committee that was tasked with overseeing the implementation of the road. In that same year, during the election of April 10, 1928, a bond issue of $2 million for Pershing Road was defeated by a vote of 381,529 to 184,751. Strongly influenced by the recommendations provided by the Chicago Plan Commission, the city of Chicago, and eventually the state of Illinois, passed a number of ordinances and engaged in legal proceedings beginning in 1929 that were directed at getting Bubbly Creek filled in. On February 4, 1929, the city government ordered that the Commissioner of Public Works be authorized and directed to proceed with the filling of Pershing Road and the filling in of Bubbly Creek between Ashland Road Avenue and 39th Street. On June 3, 1929, the Chicago City Council passed an ordinance for the opening and improvement of Pershing Road 108 feet wide between Lowell and Damon Avenues. The Chicago Plan Commission reported that in 1930, on November 5th, a paving ordinance covering the portion of Pershing Road as when open and widened was submitted to the City Council, and that the ordinance was favorably approved by the city's Committee on the Judiciary on December 11, 1930. Less than 6 months from the issuance of this ordinance, the city of Chicago made a condemnation agreement with one of the major property owners in the areas near Bubbly Creek, the Chicago City Railway Company. The final boost in filling in Bubbly Creek and completing Pershing Road was accomplished during the Depression, in the watershed period from 1931 to 1935. On January 21, 1931, The city council passed the Chicago City Railway Company agreement in connection with condemnation proceedings for the opening and widening of West Pershing Road from South Damon Avenue to Loman Avenue. This agreement was based upon a petition that the city had filed with the Superior Court of Cook County, Illinois, and sought to condemn certain property for the opening of widening of Pershing Road and for a levy to pay for the costs. The agreement resolved the dispute between the two parties and resulted in the Chicago Railway withdrawing its petition against the condemnation action of the city. On March 25, 1931, the condemnation suit ended and special assessments began to be collected. Prior to the end of the lawsuit, the city had passed a paving ordinance for a widened Pershing Road on January 10, 1931. In 1934, the Chicago City Council passed an arterial ordinance recommending that the state include Pershing Road as one of its main arterial thoroughfares that could be improved with motor fuel tax funds. This recommendation was approved by the State of Illinois Department of Public Works and Business Division Highway on August 31, 1934. On November 21, 1934, the City of Chicago was informed by the Commissioner of Public Works that an ordinance had been passed granting permission to the State of Illinois to improve West Pershing Road from South Ashland Avenue to South Halsted Street as a state highway. One of the final obstacles to the filling in of Bubbly Creek was removed on May 22, 1935, when Ward 11 Alderman Hugh B. Connolly introduced an easement ordinance. Connolly's proposed ordinance was consistent with his motto, maintenance of all necessary services at the lowest possible cost. The ordinance was unanimously accepted by the City Council on June 6, 1935, and provided for the acceptance of easements from certain property owners for the use of property for street purposes in advancement of awards to permit the early improvement of West Pershing Road. By July 21, 1935, five critically important property owners accepted the easement agreement. Their decision would virtually erode the conflict to get rid of Bubbly Creek for the sake of Pershing Road. These owners included Albert and Massey Letterman, the Anglo-American Provision Company, the Union Stockyard and Transit Company of Chicago, and the Central Manufacturing District. Another of the final hindrances was removed with the November 5, 1936 city ordinance for granting authority for an agreement with the Barrett Company in connection with the filling in of part of the West Fork of the South Branch of the Chicago River, the construction of certain sewers, and the opening and extending of West 31st Street. When Pershing Road finally opened on October 24, 1937, Alderman Connolly, an Irishman, received public recognition for his getting the project through the maze of legal technicalities involving federal, state, and city authorities. Connolly not only had a bridge named after him for his deeds in closing Bubbly Creek, he received an old shovel that had been carved from a tree that had grown on the banks of the Bubbly Creek in 1860. Connolly received the shovel because legend had it that this shovel was saved because it had been used to throw the first spadeful of dirt in the creek.
Lots of spades in Chicago. Mm-hmm. That is this week's book study session number 4 on Packing Them In, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington. We'll do it again next Thursday. Give you a shovel as a prize. Anyway, the number is 605-313-5164. the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Unless I'm misinformed, white people spent a lot of time squabbling and bickering about this filthy, I was going to say body of water, but that doesn't even seem like an accurate descriptor. They said it would, you know, crust over, animals could walk over it. Arguing about this, you know, trough, bubbly creek, and people are dying, that they said, and having health problems and all that, and they're sitting around squabbling and arguing and figure it out. You gotta go have this meeting. Like, wow. man, we talked a lot of this week about taking things seriously and getting things done in the interest of public health. Like, man, I am sure some children died and all that. Like, man, system of racism. The number is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in should be with us. Thomas in New York, our gracious narrator, Henry in Chicago. I'll look for other folks on the line. If you are with us on the line and you have not shared at all, you think you have a comment, question, you want to get in on packing them in before we wrap up for this week, please do not wait until the last few seconds. Go ahead and get your hand up right now. We'll make sure that we get you in before we get off the air. Just make sure, you know, you're not one of those who is a straggler hanging on to the very end and then deciding, yes, I do think I have a question or eight that I would like to contribute. Folks that have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
So, Gus, can you hear me?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Yes. I'm doing so much reading this week about Bubbly Creek, I had to look it up. And, man, they had a guy actually standing on all of the, that's the meat. I mean, it was actually ground to the surface of the ground, and you could actually walk out like a dock. You know, but said the area has been increasingly occupied by residential development, such as Bridgeport Village, a program to oxygenate the creek by continuous injection. Compressed air into the water has met with limited success. The creek's odor, however, has been much reduced. Some fish and vegetation has returned in recent decades. The area has been increasingly occupied by residential development. I already read that part, I'm sorry. As of 2007, the city of Chicago and the Army Corps of Engineers were considering a $2.65 million feasible study to look into the restoration options, which will have implications on the Chicago River system due to the unusual challenges of Bubbly Creek. So we're only in 2007. Problem still not solved. In 2015, the project was stalled due to contamination discovered in the creek sediment. And now they're saying in 2023, the possible restoration work begins with the Army Corps engineer by adding sludge sand to cap the creek with gravel. So we're talking 2023. So this problem still isn't solved. It's still going on. It's like we're reading the book, and I'm thinking, oh, they don't fix Bubbly Creek. Nah, still a problem. Unbelievable. And also, I didn't realize how important Chicago was back in this era. In fact, they produce more meat than the rest of the country on their stockyards. So most of the meat that was slaughtered, I guess somehow it ended up in Chicago to be slaughtered, and from Chicago it was put in refrigerated trains and sent around the rest of the country, which was something I had no idea of. So very interesting. Bubbly Creek. I might have to go to Chicago and take a look at it before they fill it.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I was looking. It still bubbles. I was not thinking that as we were reading, because, I mean, they're talking about stuff from like 200 years ago, like narrator Henry in Chicago said previously. But, I mean, yeah, I was not thinking like, oh, wow, we could go like, well, once the quarantine lifts, we could go to the Windy City right now and see all the bubbles. Be like, wow, is that Corona? Is that the Wuhan? Nope, been doing that for 200 years. That's just environmental racism. Yeah, right now, still bubbling, still a problem. That is such an embarrassment to say that we're the biggest country. Most, they talk about Chicago, it's one of the greatest cities in the world. And yes, let's go hang out at Bubbly Creek. Oh, watch your toes, watch your toes, watch your toes. Let's see. Other folks, and they are committing millions that they're talking about, committing to restoring Bubbly Creek. And let's get it right. Let's, you know, fix this problem. Get some air in there and clean it all up so it'll be wonderful. We can get the fish back and go swimming in it and all that. Compensation, restoration with everything but black people. Did we get compensation for John Burge and all that, Chicago? Maybe. Different book. Other folks who dialed in, if you have questions, comments you'd like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago.
Yeah, they made a quick reference to the SAG channel, which is called the Calumet SAG channel. Its purpose is to divert waste from Lake Michigan to the Illinois River. Now, about a block away from the Chicago or the Calumet SAG channel is the Outdale Gardens. So all that waste going from from Lake Michigan is passing through the Outdale Gardens, nearby the Outdale Gardens. So that's more toxic waste that, you know, those people that live in that particular area are being attacked with. So that's all for now.
We got some poison for you. Just lovely. And no coincidence. It all just pulls in the same direction. We send the Negras and the trash all in the same direction. So it all just nice confluence all at the reservoir there. No accidents. No coincidence. Let's see. Yeah, I felt like in this last chapter that we got to the end of chapter 4. That's where we ended at. I feel like in this chapter that we've just read, Engineering and Environmental Inequality, it was so much of it was just about all of these white people and whites at the federal level, whites at the state level, whites at the local level, Mary McLeod, like the Leach sisters, like it wasn't really black power. Not that that's the title of this book, but it wasn't really, you know, black people organizing to do something about this and different organizations or what have you. It was just white people. When it comes decision time, which you will often see in the system of racism, white supremacy, when it is decision time about what are we going to do about all this? Is it a navigable body? And are we going to fill it in? Are we going to let it stay? That is not really, you know, up to black people. We are not into, that's what I said before. When you talk about leaders, when we got to this section, leaders are the one when it's time to make a decision. All right. Everybody has an opinion about what to do with Bubbly Creek. The leaders will step forward and we will make a decision about Bubbly Creek. And then you all can be upset about it. You can pout about it or whatever, but the decision is made. And that is that. That is a leader. W.E.B. Du Bois was not a leader as it relates to Bubbly Creek. Neither was Booker T. Washington or Jesse Jackson or any other black person. She mentioned Dr. Martin Luther King. None of these folks
are leaders as it relates to black people in Chicago and any of their problems, black people anywhere else in the world and their problems. It's white people. And that absence, unless I missed it, I thought I was right here paying attention as we rolled through. They were talking to chairman and different folks about what was going to happen with this bill and different commissions, but it wasn't really too much, you know, black people sitting down at the table. This is what's going to be done, ladies and gentlemen. Doesn't matter who, you know, what you think or what you don't like. And this way, you can vote for somebody else next year, but this is what's going to happen right now. Bam. That's not what we got in Chapter 4. The Central Manufacturing District Association, CMD. I don't think that's filled up with black people. She's going on talking about the Duchess of Bubbly Creek. That is not a black person. That is Mary McDowell, the Duchess of Bubbly Creek. That's what I mean. I mean, that's a leader. That I can get things done that last permanently, not a suggestion, not an opinion. This is me out here just running, flapping my gums out on a soapbox on a cold Chicago morning. No, I know an alderman or three, or I am an alderman, or I got a governor, you know, who can get some things done permanently. And this, you know, will resolve our problem. We don't have to talk about this every other week. Let's see. Scrolling back through again, other folks who dialed in, do not wait until the last moment. And it was correctly titled Civic Power. It's the same thing when she's been talking about the body politic. We've been saying, Thomas pointed that out acutely, that seems like she's talking about white people when she uses that term in the text, body politic. In this portion, when she's been talking about power, civic power, the people who have the power, 1865, 1935, 2020, still classified as white. Unfortunately, we are trying, working to solve that problem. But recognizing that, just being truthful about that when we go to any of these different situations. What's going to happen with Bubbly Creek? White people will decide. What's going to happen with the quarantine? White people will decide. That's what white supremacy racism means. Got to be truthful about that. Other folks, comments to share. So I'm flipping through my notes. They had lots of pictures. I don't know if you want to. Might be. That's embarrassing. I keep getting ready to say, like, if you have, then I'll see something else from. I'm looking. They do have pictures in the book from this week. They have a lot of them. So if you have the book, you can check them out. If you don't have the book, if you know, it might be worth it if you go to the library after the quarantine. They closed the freaking libraries. If you go to the quarantine or the people that do have the book, flip through, you can see some of the devastation of Bubbly Creek. But that's embarrassing. They have photographs of Bubbly Creek from 1905 and 2018 of it bubbling and being rife with filth. How in the hell? Like, in 100 years, like, they put a man on the moon and all these other things have happened. You got a computer the size of your fingernail, and Bubbly Creek is still filthy and bubbling. Dedication. Global cesspool. That is what Dr. Kambon said. They got lots of these pictures of the filth of Chicago. If you want to check it out in the book this week, it is fascinating to see. And then you can go look online, like I said, like Thomas in New York did, and see the updated, like in color, bright HD versions of the Chicago filth at Bubbly Creek. Not that they got this other places. We're just focused on this one location. Now, other folks who dialed in, the number again, 605-313-5164. Or the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61. Any comments, questions to share?
Interesting with white people and these nicknames. Mary McDowell, known as the Duchess of Bubbly Creek and Garbage Woman and all this other kind of cute nicknames that they have, kind of reminds me of what was happening when the white women were calling the police on, you know, black people congregating, you know, Barbecue Becky and all these other kind of crazy names. So I kind of thought about that when she was mentioning these self-titled names for Mary McDowell. So that's all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Although, I mean, if you want to self-apply, I'm the, you know, Duchess of Bubbly Creek. Whatever authority that's supposed to suggest with that little title, these little tacky name, the tackiness even, because they put these little tacky titles on these areas where we already know these are some non-white people, whether they're so-called white ethnics, so-called Latinos or black people. We got the Negros there, whatever. Some non-white people that, you know, they are life unworthy of life. Who cares? We'll dump all the foul and filth and industrial waste. We'll dump that all back there on top of their rooftops. And we'll give it a cute name. We'll call it the Bottoms. Yes. The Back of the Yards. Yes. The South Side. Yes. Come on. Or we'll put something cute on it. Altgale Gardens. Yes. Yes. Flowers. And, you know, oh, my God. Acid waste is raining down on us. Yes. We'll come up with some little cute name like that to hang on it. Then I'll give myself a nickname for cleaning up this dump, or at least trying to. Again, 100 years later, still bump. They will, and they'll come in and they'll make little hodgepodge tacky repairs. They'll come in and say, oh, we're going to tear down Cabrini Green's housing project. They will tear this down and put up something nice and just kind of go hodgepodge. I think our narrator, Henry in Chicago, he talked about they came in and put up a trauma center after they had complained and lots of black people had been shot and killed. And all right, we'll put in traumas. Let's just go hodgepodge a little bit here, a little bit there, as opposed to, how about just make it correct? Make it look the same way that it looks on the North Side, on the Gold Coast in Chicago, some of the other posh parts of the city. Why don't you make it look the same? Make it the same as it looks in Evanston. Make it the same as the way it looks on the campus up at Northwestern. How about that? Yeah. We don't have money. Yeah, we blew all our money on the Corona budget. Yeah. Everybody good? Anything else they wanted to make sure they get in? Second portion of the reading. Virus notwithstanding, we'll be here tomorrow for workplace racism. That should be a fascinating exchange. Like, now to have a full week of, now how has this impacted your workplace? Had some cows listers, they wrote in and said that people on the job started coughing and they were ready to leave. And some other wild things. The handshake has been done away with. Wild times on the plantation. But that'll be 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific tomorrow. In addition to people working from home and trying to adjust to all of that, amazing times. We will review tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, that'll be Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And again, the goal, do the Global Sunday Talk on Racism this Sunday. Normal time for that broadcast, which is early in the day so that we can get people from different parts of the globe. I feel like this, you know, mandatory. I've been emailing folks different parts of the planet, like, let's get in here. Let's make time. Let's get in here. This is important, like, to see what your observations are, your part of the world. We have cows listeners that are in China. Some of them have been saying, hey, this is really serious. Take this seriously. This is a big problem. I was just here with the quarantine and all the rest of it. So I think this is one. It is important. It is a global system of white supremacy racism. This is one. Triangulate is one of the words that we've used before, getting information from as many different sources as possible so that you can process and follow logic, come to an accurate logical assessment about what's the best thing to do, best way to proceed. But Global Sunday Talk on Racism, the goal, have it this Sunday, the normal time, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 p.m. Pacific. So that would be early in the day. Sun is still shining so that we can get folks from different parts of the globe on at their, whatever the time difference happens to be, to share what they have seen with the opening week or so of this so-called pandemic. What's happening on their job, what regulations or rules does it look like might be changing in their so-called country. Very important. We'll be working hard to make sure that that goes down this Sunday. Last check. Anything else? Folks need to make sure they get in before we call it a broadcast. Packing them in, session 4.
Yeah, I think, Gus, that sometimes we forget how important, important is a tough word, but for lack of better words, important Chicago is to black people, where we has about 1 million black people that live in the city, and a lot of them are homeowners allowed to own property right now by white people. And, you know, it's the headquarters to very recognizable black organizations, the Rainbow Coalition, the Nation of Islam. I believe the Moorish Science Temple is headquartered there. It's a shame, that, these white people destroyed these parts of this city, which wasn't theirs in the first place. And then after destroying them, they were accepted as white and moved on, and who replaced them in these areas that were contaminated, but the black people. South Side Chicago, I believe that's where the black people live. I think an ongoing process of white supremacy in all the major cities, this is what you saw was, Chicago, if that's what was going on in Chicago, of course, this situation was unique because of the stockyards. But you had the same waste going on in other St. Louis and Memphis and Atlanta and, all these other cities, they were built on waste. They had to have built somehow. And I would guarantee you that all the places where they destroyed before they decided to enforce laws to make things better, those are the areas that the black people ended up residing in when it was all said and done. And I'm also firmly believe that as soon as those areas become environmentally friendly again, those black people will be removed. And I'll be my mind. Thank you, Gus. And I'll be there Saturday, Sunday. I can't wait.
Well, I am excited about Sunday myself, hoping I will be allowed to be present also. Global Sunday Talk on Racism, long-awaited return. Wish it could have been under better circumstances, not with us all being on lockdown. Let's see, our caller in Canada, do you have any commentary you were going to share as well?
Oh, hello, Gus, and hello, Kyle's callers. I just wanted to say that I understand now what they call biohazard, because it's obvious that Bubbly Click was a biohazard. And to imagine that from all of this time till 2019, it is still polluted. And it's, it doesn't look the same, of course, back from the 19th century. But it was basically, a big open area. And there was sand, and then they had, in the 19th century, they had all of these, packing factories, and the factories that made the cans and put the meat in it. And then they'd pour all of the entrails and all of the waste from the packing. And then to think from all of that time, and today, Bubbly Creek is still polluted, I mean, that's really fascinating, to say the least. And to realize that from all that time, through environmental racism, they had the nerve to make sure that many black people are near those areas. So, and then I've always wondered, why did people have such low birth rates and such low lifespans, because they were living in very polluted areas. And, then I understand why a lot of people didn't live to the age of 40 and died very, very young. So I guess because of the pollution. And then there was something else that I wanted to say. I think that's it. Thank you.
Much obliged, our caller in Canada. We started today the audio segment from the CBC Community of Widows. Pollution, killing off black males. It was poisoning all of the black people in that area. Perhaps it was some sort of ethno-specific chemical and biological warfare, but Community of Widows. Again, the tacky names. They get applied to these towns, but there you go. Global system of white supremacy racism from Chicago to Canada. They do the same thing. Life unworthy of life, trash, and black people.
Mm. Population tailoring, sir.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 24 hours, we'll be here. Neutralizing workplace racism. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Like I said, fascinating week. Should not have spectators. You should be self-distancing and on quarantine. So you should definitely be able to dial in tomorrow. And wow, this was our workplace. We should have some changes to policy and procedure, changes to paid sick leave, all kinds of things. Sanitation policy, crude jokes about the Kung Flu. Oh, my. I cannot wait. Workplace racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. You can drop an email if you cannot participate live. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Anywho, much obliged for the folks who tuned in live and or listened to the archives. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. We'll be back for packing them in next week. With that, Creator, we ask that you forgot most important. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Absolutely. Super important. That is part of the environmental racism. Dump all kinds of chemicals and what have you. Until, oh, this is I told you they had closed down everything. I was walking through the middle of downtown Seattle. They had closed everything on the street. The only two establishments that were open, the police department and the liquor store. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. Every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger, if you're driving, you are buckled, sober, and you are not on the cell phone. I am not sure. It would seem enforcement officials around the world should have better things to do than ticket and worry about if somebody is texting and driving, but we are still in a system of white supremacy racism. So I still think if I'm a black person in a vehicle, even if I have a mask on, I do not think enforcement officials are going to be lenient or have any sort of discretion with me. Sober, buckled, not on the cell phone if you are driving. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in. You can check in on other victims of racism. Make sure they have water, toilet paper, if you have a roll to spare. Check in, assist other non-white people during these confusing times. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.